And good afternoon from the captain's chair. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. And we are coming to you, as always, live, unrehearsed, and unscripted from the voice of Vashon, 101.9 on the frequency modulation band, and streamed live from voiceofvashon.org. And as promised, and I always try to deliver on my promises, my friend today is Bill West. And Bill, welcome to Gathering Around the Captain's Chair.
Thank you, Captain Joe.
So I want to do a little bit of housekeeping with you first. And a few broadcasts ago, I had a little piece about people's titles and qualifications and education and the initials that go after their name. So tell me the initials that go after your name.
Well, MSc in fisheries and Juris Doctor.
Right. So it is the Juris Doctor that I want to say something about. Juris Doctor, of course, is Latin, and the legal profession and the RC Church still persist in using Latin, and the medical profession as well, using Latin in some of the in some of their activities. And so the term Juris Doctor means Doctor of Laws. And so my friend Bill is not only holds a master's in fisheries, but he is also an attorney. And Bill, I believe that you specialized in admiralty law.
Yes, it was a bit of an overlap between admiralty and maritime, which has to do with, say, longshoremen and so on, as opposed to admiralty, which has to do with ships and shipping and sailors, and natural resources and environmental law, especially as they applied to work or activities on or near the water.
So we're going to talk about a couple of things today in which I'm going to ask for your particular knowledge and skills. Before we get into that, I'm going to make my customary reference to the binnacle list and to point out that today in this country we now have over 400,000 people with empty chairs around the dining room table. And furthermore, in amongst Captain Joe's people since last week, we've had some people who are near, close, and dear to me who we are hoping will be on the binnacle list for a very, very short period of time. So moving on to the areas in which I want to talk to Bill. The first one, Bill, there was a report just in this last week of a case of piracy off of the coast of Nigeria, in which, in this particular case, one of the crew members was killed, and 15 members of the crew were kidnapped. And from the and there's not been any particularly robust effort to go after the people that are doing this. And there are a number of economic reasons why this is on the uptick, but it is, there is a rising curve of piracy in that in the Gulf of Guinea. From the point of view of the maritime lawyer, how from a legal point of view might we go at this? I'm talking now about once, let us say, that the military captures these people, what can happen to them then?
Well, the laws around piracy are go back deep into history, and they are quite explicit and rather brief. Execution is the typical punishment for someone that has been convicted of piracy. I'm certainly no expert in military justice, but I would expect that there would, if a person suspected of piracy were captured by our military anyway, they would be put on trial in a court martial. They would be represented by a military attorney, and there would be another military attorney. We call them adjutants, typically, would be the prosecutor, and there would be a panel of judges who would be officers of sufficient experience and training that they could serve as judges in a situation like this. But if convicted, death is the standard penalty. And I don't know what countries do along those lines, if they have abolished the death penalty in their own legal systems. But whoever's doing this had better hope they don't get caught by the U.S. Navy.
Yes. And what is very troubling to me is that this is going on with, at least now, and maybe this particular incident, because there was a death involved. One of the crew members was killed in the attack. And that this will motivate either some sort of an international force to be stood up, or that the country off whose shores, in this case Nigeria, would take some action. It's, of course, piracy goes back probably since the beginning of time. And when man first straddled that log, there probably was somebody who wanted to take that log away from him. So we're not talking about something that is new. And certainly one of the reasons why the Coast Guard, which was then called the Revenue Cutter Service, was organized in 1790 was to combat piracy. And we still do it today. However, we are not deployed to the Gulf of Guinea, and that's one of the things that we should be doing. The when you and I talked about coming on the program, I had told you that one of the areas of some concern and alarm to me is what's happening in my much-loved United Kingdom, and in particular the separation of the United Kingdom from the rest of the European Union. And one of the areas in which you have particular skills and knowledge is both in fisheries management, because you did that quite a bit. And in fact, you sailed in Coast Guard cutters as part of that of your life, but also the legal aspects of it. And you had told me that you would then do a little bit of looking into it from your side. So I'm going to now probe around the edges of the results of your investigations, and let's talk a little bit about that.
All right. Happy to do it. I think that under the current plans, and they, of course, are subject to change, but under the current plans of the negotiations for post-Brexit relationships between the UK and the EU, over a period of the next 5 or so years, the UK will regain full jurisdiction over its exclusive economic zone. And I'm going to have to get into a little bit of jargon here. I'm just going to call it the EEZ because it is shorter. Every nation under the United Nations Convention for the Law of the Sea has the right to manage its economic resources and economic activities that take place within 200 miles of its coastline. Now, where you have countries that are close enough together that that these overlap, then there's a maritime boundary drawn that divides that portion of the sea and the seabed between the two countries along a formula that I won't get into. But Britain, as an island nation, has a very large exclusive economic zone, and historically it has been a very rich and productive area for fisheries. Now, when the UK joined the EU, its control over its own EEZ was diminished. It had to be made subservient to the common fisheries policy of the EU, which meant that Britain was no longer responsible for managing its fishery resources within its 200-mile limit. Its fishery resources were managed by an international council chartered under the EU that commissioned the research and then crunched the numbers and allocated, well, first set a quota for what species could be harvested, how much of each species could be harvested, and then allocated it along various formulas among the various participating EU nations. And what this meant was that after the UK joined the EU, its fishing industry was pretty much decimated. They no longer had exclusive access to their fishery resources, and for a lot of technical and political and economic reasons, they felt that their resources were not being managed very well. I was involved in the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea, which is one of the informal coordinating bodies that operates, among other things, with the EU to do the research and do the analysis and that underlies these quotas. I was not involved in that aspect of it, but I knew how it worked. And generally speaking, the countries that are subject to the common fisheries policy are, their fishers are not very happy about it. You may or may not know that a few years ago, Norway had a referendum on whether or not to join the EU.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that, yes.
And they, there was a nationwide referendum, and while it was a close race, membership was rejected by the Norwegian population, mm-hmm. and a very large part of the reason for that was that the Norwegian fishing industry, which is not just an industry in Norway, it's a way of life. It is an integral part of their culture and who they are. They did not want to see their resources, which are also large and rich, subject to management by the EU. They felt that their livelihoods would be destroyed and the resources would be destroyed. When fisheries research and management are weak, then resources are very easily wiped out. So that's the British fishers are very excited about sovereignty over their resources returning to British management. Now, nations can do a bad job of managing fisheries just as well as multinational organizations, and we don't have to look very far to find some examples. But at least there is a chance there's a chance for more accountability and more transparency and more integration between the people that depend on the resources and the people that are managing the resources if it is returned to British sovereignty, as is currently in the pipeline.
So you brought up the Convention on the Law of the Sea. And I believe that you had told me that you had done some work as part of some group that was involved with developing that. And yet the United States has not yet signed on to the Law of the Sea Convention.
Well, that's right. The United States, well, most of the countries of the world that border saltwater are, well, almost all of them are signatories to UNCLOS, Law of the Sea. The U.S. is a striking exception, and although we abide by most of its established protocols and practices and are signatories to various different clauses, such as things having to do with pollution at sea and discarding of garbage or plastic at sea. Mm-hmm. So in effect, we are fully participating members and are pretty, I'd say, pretty committed to that. But the U.S. has never signed that convention because of reservations that the U.S. has about seabed resources out on the high seas that are outside of any nation's economic zone. There are, I have heard, some very rich deposits of various valuable materials on the seafloor out on the high seas, and but they're, you know, they may be rich and abundant and pretty easily found, but they're not cheap to recover. And the Law of the Sea has declared those resources to be part of the common property of all humankind, so that if any enterprise or nation were to start harvesting them, there would be there would have to be some kind of distribution of the proceeds from that harvest to nations or peoples or organizations that had not participated in the investment and the effort to harvest these materials. And so the U.S., because of our technology and our industrial base, American interests are probably leading contenders to start harvesting those resources, but they don't want to harvest them just to benefit someone else. So as long as we are not a member of the Law of the Sea Convention, then our businesses would not be bound by that. So that's the short answer. There are lots of others. I'd say except for that point, we're full participating member of the Law of the Sea Convention, and in fact, one of its stronger proponents on the diplomatic stage.
That's a really interesting concept, though, that we participate. We participated in the crafting of the language of the treaty, and yet we have not yet acceded to that treaty. From your best professional judgment, Bill, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that the United States will eventually, as we evolve, in particular with our activities in the Arctic, do you think that we may eventually accede to that treaty?
A couple of my ex-wives would tell you that my ability to predict the future is terrible, but I'd say that this is a living thing, that as circumstances change. For example, I'm really interested to see what would happen if China, the People's Republic of China, were to start harvesting seabed resources. I believe they're a signatory to the Law of the Sea, but they've never let that stop them from doing anything they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I think if there were that kind of activity going on, that might change the viewpoints of some of the folks in the United States.
So the concept that a particular resource or a particular area of the world is held in reserve for the good of all mankind is the basis on which the Antarctic Treaty was constructed. Mm-hmm. And the Antarctic Treaty, of course, is both of personal interest to me. I helped to enforce it when I was sailing. And I have a number of people in my Cambridge family who actually helped to develop the Law of the Sea Treaty. So it's my understanding that there are a couple of provisions of the Law of the Sea Treaty which are objectionable to Americans because of the ceding of sovereignty. And that, of course, is an area in which we have been particularly sensitive since the founding of this particular of our republic. So it will be interesting to see how it goes. But when you mentioned the Law of the Sea, I was compelled to ask you what you're thinking and what your feelings about it are. And the fact that we participate, that we help to develop, is much the same as what happened with the League of Nations. And that takes me to the book that I have been talking about a couple of times here that was written by Josephus Daniels, who was Wilson's Secretary of the Navy, who made all of Navy and Coast Guard ships dry, and who wrote the history, the story of the Wilson era in two volumes. And he wrote those right after World War II, of all things. And I was trawling through it, as is my custom, and I came across a quote which I'm going to read right here. And this is about the U.S. Coast Guard in World War I. Now, the Coast Guard acquired that name in 1915, and it was a renaming of the Revenue Cutter Service. And so in 1917, when the United States went into World War I, the Coast Guard automatically shifted over to be a part of the Navy, as we did in World War II. So here's what Josephus says about that. He says, with the declaration of war, the Coast Guard automatically came under the Navy. It ought to have such status in peace as well. Franklin Roosevelt, Franklin was Daniel's assistant secretary of the Navy before he developed polio, and I had hoped that that would follow the armistice. But Secretary of the Treasury Carter Glass was too quick for us and had it returned to the Treasury while I, Josephus, was in Hawaii. Aloha, Josephus. No department in Washington surrenders anything voluntarily, and we are seeing that over and over again in our world today. Josephus goes on to say, the ships and men of the Coast Guard won distinction. The Tampa was destroyed by a torpedo. The Wellington was lost. Captain John A. Midget and crew of the, I never get this one right. This is one of the life-saving stations out on the Outer Banks. Chicamacamaco Station, North Carolina, were given high commendation for going through a sea of blazing oil to rescue the crew of the Samolo. This was only one of the actions beyond the call of duty. So in the Coast Guard today, we always have a Coast Guard cutter Tampa in the fleet. She was lost with all hands as a convoy escort in World War I. And we now always have a Midget in the Coast Guard fleet. And that is in recognition of not just Captain John Midget, but of all the Midgets who have served in the Coast Guard. I have been shipmates with several of them, and they have sent people into the Coast Guard for generation after generation. And, Bill, you probably have served with one or two of them sometime in your seagoing career with the Coast Guard. So I'm going to take us to another really important matter on which I solicit your professional judgment and opinion, tempered, no doubt, by the relationships of your former wives. In a broadcast not too long ago, we talked about the world-shaking problem of lint in the dryer. And I solicited opinions from all of Captain Joe's people out there, all the way from Singapore in one end of the world to Stockholm in the other end of the world. And I received not a great deal of information, which told me that either Captain Joe's people have no opinion or they never clean the dryer. Well, I perforce now have to clean the dryer, and that's how I became aware of this particular problem. So my daughter Gina and my son-in-law Bob are here now, and they are reconstructing the upstairs head in my home in Captain's Quarters. And the subject came up because Gina had forgotten to clean the lint filter in the dryer, and I brought her up to short stay on that. And then I said, where does it all come from? Where do you think it comes from? And she said, microfiber. So, Bill, what do you think about lint dryer? Dryer lint.
Well, I actually, never was a cause of conflict with any of my wives, including the current one, because when I do run the dryer, I find it sort of obscenely satisfying to scrape the lint off the filter and throw it away. It's just one of those little obsessive compulsive things that that please me. Its origin, I guess, is pretty straightforward. It's just, you know, every garment we wear is made of fibers, and little bits and pieces of them break off and go somewhere, and if they don't go out into the backyard or into the filter, then I don't know where they go.
So since I know and love your current wife and did not know and love your previous ones, I can only
nor do I.
I can only say that whatever happens with it, it can only be a good thing. And I'm going to continue the search on this because this is obviously a question that requires some really high-level investigation and then putting the subject to rest. On a more serious note, I was really heartened by the opening remarks by the new Secretary of the Defense, Secretary of Defense General Austin. In his first communication to the entire Department of Defense, in which I'm certain he also included the Coast Guard, although we are now pro tem anyway in the Department of Homeland Security. He talked about attacking as one of his first things this whole question that we have discussed on this program about sexual assaults within the military establishment. And I said then, and I say now, that I cannot understand how shipmates, and it is shipboard people that I know the most about, I've commanded thousands of them, and I just cannot understand how a shipmate could behave in any other way than to watch the six of his or her shipmates. So General Austin, Secretary Austin, has made a particular comment about this in his opening remarks to his to the entire Department of Defense. And essentially what he is saying is that it's not happening in his command, and it is time for it to end. And I believe, and he also said, I'm not waiting for some commission. There were commissions being established and all kinds of groups being put together to study this. And hell, everybody knows, everybody who has ever commanded, everybody who has ever served knows how it happens and why it happens and what to do about it. So I am really heartened by the way that General Austin is taking on this job. I believe very strongly in the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense, and that we should have military people go into that job only in extraordinary circumstances. And I believe that we are in those extraordinary circumstances now. The first one who was the first military and who was also the first Secretary of Defense was, of course, George Marshall. And Marshall needed the waiver to assume that task. It was given to him just as it was given to General Mattis and now to General Austin. I believe that that exception should be exercised sparingly, and I believe that this is an appropriate time to have exercised that particular waiver. So, General Austin, I do not say good luck because we make all of our own luck in this life, but I say well done for your opening remarks to the troops. And I, for one, will be watching very carefully to see how all of this is put into execution. So I'm going to tell a Mike Lowry story. You remember Mike Lowry, yes. Bill?
Yes.
What many people have forgotten, that they remember that Mike was our governor. Mm-hmm. But what many people did not know was that he was a congressman from the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. And so here's my Mike Lowry story. And Mike has crossed his own bar now. If he were alive and he were to hear this broadcast, he would, I'm sure, remember the story that I'm going to tell about him. And it is this. I was, when I was the ICE boss for everything that the Coast Guard did in ice-covered waters all over the world for Commandant Jim Gracie, we were laying out the design parameters for the icebreaker that's homeported here in Seattle, our ship that we now know as the Coast Guard Cutter Healy. And we were laying out the design parameters for her, and I was told to go and testify before the Coast Guard subcommittee, of which Mike was the chair, and to lay out the groundwork for the funding of this particular ship and the need for it. So I went to the hearing room, and Congressman Lowry was sitting in the chair, and I was sitting in the witness chair, and I took the oath, and then Congressman Lowry looked down, and I noticed that he had a beard. I noticed that you have a beard, in fact.
Indeed,
a well-developed beard. You would win the contest in any one of my beard-growing contests at sea. So I noticed that he was growing a beard, and I said, "Congressman, before we get going with my testimony, I notice that you are wearing a beard. And this was at a time when the Coast Guard was wrestling with, do we continue to allow beards, or do we now tell sailors that they can no longer grow beards? The whole beard permission came from Elmo Zumwalt when he was the chief of naval operations. And the commandant of the Coast Guard at that time was Chester Bender, Admiral Bender. And they were the two that allowed beards. And it had been a contentious subject for all the years that the privilege had been in place. And so the Coast Guard was wrestling with that. And I looked up to the chair. When you're at the witness table, you look up to the presiding officer. And I said, Congressman, I noticed that you're wearing a beard. Could it be that this was in some way of trying to influence the commandant as to which way he should go in this decision about whether to continue to allow beards? And he said, no, Captain, I didn't really think about it that way, but since you brought it up, what do you think about this beard? And I said, well, I am under oath. And it is a little bit thin on the face. I would suggest that if you're going to continue with it, that you do whatever you can to encourage its further growth and fullness. And he said, well, well done. I will take that under advisement. And then we went forward, and I gave my testimony about Healy. Healy got funded.